Seymour Knox. Seymour Knox is about my height. As a matter of fact, when we lined up in
class. How tall are you?
I'm 5'2". So anyway, in those days, by the way, I want to mention this too, because this was very helpful to me. Yale was the first university in the United States that, prior to our entry into World War I, became the forerunner of the ROTC, called the Students' Army Training Corps. And when you entered, you were immediately put in uniform. And very fortunately for me, I didn't have clothes or like these people, but I looked like them because I wore a uniform exactly the way they did, see?
You had a ROTC.
I wore exactly the same uniform that they wore, don't you see? And so I looked alike. And so, again, I must say, I was like the class baby. I weighed only 95 pounds in those days. I always was impish in my reactions to everything. And I was good-natured, but I had nothing to complain about, you know. And I took everything was so wonderful to me here. This was so foreign to me. I was so naive. I was so green.
Homesick at all?
Pardon?
So far from home?
I didn't get homesick. I never had that experience of being homesick. But I was always, I wrote letters very often, at least once a week. I'll never forget the first letter I wrote home was when I was admitted to Yale. I didn't have a Yale stationery or anything like that. I had no stationery, but there was one of those public rooms like they have here, you know. Yale had it, and they had Yale stationery.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote that first letter that I'm admitted to Yale on Yale stationery. Uh-huh. I'll never forget what a thrill it gave me. But anyway, at the end of the first year, I was doing so well. Here was my brother at the University of Kentucky. So I said to my brother, what do you want to go to the University of Kentucky for? You're smart. He was all A, my brother was. I said, you're smart. Why don't you come to Yale? I'll see if I can get you in. So I was so naive. I didn't know you're supposed to go to the dean or the admissions or anything like that. I went to the president. I went to see Hadley, the president. President Hadley said to me, I'm very sorry, but Yale does not take exchange students.
Yeah.
So, but about a week later, I got a note from President Hadley saying, I think I got a way to get your brother in.
Oh.
So what was, I went to see Hadley. Hadley said to me, you know, we got this ROTC, this Yale says, I can get him into the training unit because it's under federal jurisdiction or something like that, but you have to take the classes at Yale. All the regular classes, see? I can take him into those conditions. So, okay, so next year my brother came, see? So anyway, 2 years later, of course, by that time we learned about Smith. And, you know, so my sister graduated from high school. It's Smith, you know, it couldn't be anything else. The pattern had been set already, you know, we're going along. Now that I always want to say this about my brother. And my brother was a valedictorian of his class. And my brother won the highest medal that Yale had to offer, called the Stone Corporation Prize. My brother won.
What was your brother's name?
Ben Lowenthal.
And he was in the class of?
1919. You're ahead of me, see? And I'm the class of 1920. And in those days, because of the war, we went all year round, class, all through the summer and so on. And then I wanted to go that way anyway because, you know, I didn't have time. I wanted to finish this spot. So I went to Yale College and Yale Law School all in 5 years. I did it all.
Undergraduate and law school.
And law school combined,
wow.
See, yes. But the three whole summers, I graduated in law school in September of 1921.
Wow.
I graduated from Yale Law School, and I was associate editor of the Yale Law Journal. Just want you to know.
Wow.
But anyway, we Lowenthals did very, very well at Yale. And as I said, at the end of the first year, we caught on. And one of the things we caught on to was that in those days, there were tutoring schools at Yale that tutored students at Yale as well as prospects who want to get into Yale. And I taught at one of those. And I taught with Bob Hutchins, later became the great president of the University of Chicago and so on and so forth. Bob was there. Bob's brother was a classmate of mine. Bob was about 2 years behind me, but he taught it there. So I got to know Bob Hudson very well when he became the world head of this, that, the other thing. I used to go visit them in Santa Barbara. Again, only because, as a matter of fact, at the end of 1921, when Hadley gave up the presidency of Yale, Bob Hutchins' father was the president of the same university, the same school in Kentucky that I told you for the hillbillies.
Oh. Yeah.
And I carried on a campaign to try to make his father the next president of Yale. I didn't get anywhere with him, but I ran the campaign. But I did things like this all the way through in my career, see. Now that my brother and I worked our way through by, we used to draw outlines of courses, see, in physics and math and so on, and then sell to the next year, freshmen or sophomores that were coming in and so on and so forth. And anyway, we worked our way through, but we worked way, way on the table, and I'll never forget another thing. The same man was the head of the Bureau of Appointments, so I said to him, I can eat and I can sleep and so on and so forth. Well, he said, don't worry, I got that taken care of too. He said, the Yale Bowl had just opened up. And famous for football, the Yale Football Bowl. And Yale played 5 or 6 games a year there. There were 30 entrances to the bowl, see. And they used to sell programs for 50 cents in those days. And I got 25 cents for each. I was one of the entrances. I sold three. The first Saturday, I sold 70. I sold 300 of them. I got $75 in cash. You hear what I said? And then next week, I got 75 more in cash. But then I did everything else. I filled envelopes. I did every kind of thing that you can possibly do. They would keep saying, the one thing I wouldn't do, once they called me up, they asked me if I'd be a professional pallbearer.
Oh!
And I said, they were going to give me $10 for being a professional pallbearer. I said, no. But then, that's all part of it.
Tell us more about your classmates, about Henry Luce.
That was Henry. I told you, Thornton Wilder. But they were Rockefellers, and there were Vanderbilts, and there were Whitneys, and all the great names. Davidson, who would have J.P. Morgan and company, and so on and so forth. I didn't know what these names meant, even, see. But I tutored Sonny Whitney from Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney. I tutored him. And so on. I tutored, what's his name? Dean Atchison's younger brother to get him into Yale and pass the exam. Dean Atchison was a class of 1918 or something like that, but we got mixed up on account of the war, you know. And not only that, Charlie Taft became one of my greatest friends. It was William Howard Taft. And not only that, I wanted to tell you, when I went to Yale Law School, I studied constitutional law with William Howard Taft. He had been president of the United States. And after he was president of the United States, before he became the Chief Justice, he went back to Yale and taught the constitutional law. You know, I studied with him, so on. But anyway, my whole life was distorted. I took my whole family then and moved them out. Like I told you, my brother came here, then my sister went to Smith. And my sister saw all these girls. My sister had to make her own clothes at Smith, you know, and so on and so forth. We didn't have any money. And all this kind of, she worked too. My brother and I and my sister, we were the ones of the long ones who worked, see, our way through, all the way through, and so on. So we got to know, and just as I got to know these people, so my brother got to know people like this, my sister got to know people like this, and my sister found out, for example, one of the girls I got to know up there, and I probably invited her to a couple of Yale parties then, you know, was Sis Norman. Who is Sis Norman? I didn't know until many years later. She was a granddaughter of who found Sears Roebuck?
Rosenwald.
Sure, she's a granddaughter. Their name wasn't, by the way, their name was Nussbaum. Her mother's name was Nussbaum. See, and so on, your granddaughter said. And I got, and through this, again, I'll show you another thing. Through Sis Norman, I got to know her older brother, Ed Norman. And 50, 60 years ago, our adventure, Ed Norman and I founded the American Israel Cultural Foundation.
Oh.
Ed Norman and I founded for Habimo in Israel and all those. I am a founder of that with Ed Norman. Ed Norman, you know, the Rosenwald family was sharply divided between
anti-Zionists
and very pro-Zionists, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the Norman part, the Nussbaum, they didn't like Nussbaum,
oh,
nut tree.
Norman.
See, they changed it to Norman, see.
Okay. The Nussbaum.
See. And so, but anyway, here, and my sister got to know all these things, you know, and so on. And we changed our lives, and we've got to move out of this poverty-stricken thing, you know, and take on the new thing we know, see, from then on. So the long thought become art collectors, and the long thought become collectors of ancient instruments, and the long thought become, I can't tell you how many things we become.
They're
so unrelated to anything that our background involves us in, you see. So anyway,
you started to say that you met Charles Rosenblum
at
the beginning.
He became my best friend.
Okay, tell us about Charles and his family.
Charles Rosenblum's father was Saul Rosenblum.
From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, that's right. I believe he was one of the biggest liquor men in the world. He was a very, very rich man. And he used to come to visit his son, and he used to take me to lunch also. And he was very much interested because I had told him about my grandfather founding Rishon LeZion. And my father, I didn't tell you this either, my father founded Chovei LeZion, Lovers of Zion, which when the Brandeis puts together the Zionist Organization of America in about 1905, 1906, my father's organization merged with Brandeis, and so on and so forth. And my father used to, when these, what they call Shalichim, came from Israel in those days, who were the founders of Zionism, people like Ussishkin and people like that. Can I go?
Sure.
Well, Mr. Rosenblum, when Prohibition came in, he decided to sell everything. He owned many, many distilleries and whiskey warehouses, and he was one of the biggest distributors of whiskeys, wines, and everything in the whole country, and so on and so on. Very, very rich. But he decided to sell out. And he decided to put his son into the banking business, the investment banking. And he was fascinated by me. And even though I was a graduate lawyer, and I had an offer to teach at Yale, teach law at Yale.
Uh-huh.
And every big firm in the country, I was associated with the Yale Law Journal. I'd written articles and so on and so forth. And I had bids from practically every big law firm in America. But I was the second oldest, and we needed money. And so when he decided to go into the banking business, he asked me if I'd be his partner. So that's how I came to Pittsburgh in 1921, in September of 1921. And we went into the investment banking business. And from then on, Charles Rosenblum and I remained our closest friends, despite the fact that we dissolved the business for business reasons, took up again, and so on and so forth. And I never knew anybody who's, with the exception of my wife, whose interests and desires and values were more congenial with my own. In every way, not that we didn't differ on certain things, but we agreed to disagree then on certain things. But generally speaking, and particularly vis-a-vis Israel, and vis-a-vis public causes, liberal causes in the United States. Because I'd had this great opportunity to associate with so many people who later on went into public life. As a matter of fact, I've been troubled all my life. Well, supposing I had followed the other drummer and become a lawyer, I'd have been a judge. So many of friends of mine out of the Supreme Court of the United States became governors and senators and so on and so forth. As a matter of fact, I like to think of what the hell is his name? Mac, the Secretary of Commerce, who
Mac Baldridge.
Baldridge, yeah. Baldridge's father.
Oh.
Was a classmate of mine, and in law school, and he was a tremendous guy like this, you know, and I was this little guy like this. He said, loved me, but I was smart, you know, and he said, pick me up and throw me around, and so on and so forth. And I remember when he used to bring this Baldridge and his sister up for reunions and so on and so forth. She became the secretary to Jackie.
Letitia.
You should bring her up. Not only that, Jackie Onassis, Jackie Kennedy, her father, I mentioned him, was a classmate of mine.
Auchincloss?
UD. We call them UD. UD Auchincloss. I knew her when she was a little girl. He married a second time, uh-huh. Yeah, and married her mother and so on, so he raised her and so on. Matter of fact, for reunions, her father used to bring Helen 70 or 80 foot yachts. He used to bring it up and we'd have parties on the yachts and so on. But I knew Jackie when she was a little girl.
Huh.
And so on.
Did you see her when she was first lady?
Oh, I certainly was. I was the state co-treasurer for Kennedy of Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the inaugural ball and everything like that. And, I must say, I told you, I was in liberal causes. In 1932, I went to Chicago for the convention that nominated Franklin Roosevelt. And I was in the same box with Haywood Broome. And a couple of days before Franklin Roosevelt was nominated, he'd been the governor away in New York, you know. Well, Haywood Broome issued a broadside called Roosevelt, the corkscrew politician. I'll never forget my argument with Haywood Broome about that. But I knew all those...
He was an announcer?
Haywood Broome was a big columnist for the New York World Tribune and so on and so forth.
And his son later was Hayward Hale Broome.
That's right. That's his son. That's right. But here I got to know all these people. Out of Harvard, for example. As I told you, I knew them too. See, I used to go up to Harvard and I got to know these people. So then both of my kids went to Harvard. But Yale wasn't taking girls in those days. So.
Well, I find it interesting that you said you were in the liberal causes,
that's
where
right.
A lot of the people
that's
that attended
right.
Yale
always,
then were more conservative.
Nobody could have been more out of place than I was at Yale. Here I am. Poor Jews have no place else to go. I was a poor Jew. Where else can you go except for liberal causes, see? But I actually believed in them. My father believed in them. And I believed in them. My brother believed in them. My family believed in them. We still do. And we took part. We were active in everything. We always were active. And everything we believed in, we did something about. And I always like to think of my first experiences in Pittsburgh here when I first came here. And because I was articulate and I had this background, and we were the first Jewish bankers in Pittsburgh. So there was one Lowenthal, were the first Jewish bankers. You know. Other bankers didn't like us, by the way. And we were insignificant. We were nobodies. We were just starting out, you know. But anyway, they didn't like us. But I was very articulate. But Charles Rosenblum had marvelous taste there, but he wasn't very articulate. And so I started spoken. I got the credit. For everything, for many of things that really belonged to him, that he backed up with his money. See?
Uh-huh.
But the one thing we had in common all our lives, in addition to being liberals on the American scene, we, in 1917, when I want to get this on the record, when the Balfour Declaration came in, that's in November of 1917, Brandeis at that time was already on the bench, on the Supreme Court bench.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the provisional head of the Zionist organization. And Brandeis wanted to change the coloration of the Zionist organization from East European, Yiddish-speaking Jews to college graduates. Now, Brandeis himself, you know, he went to Harvard Law School, but he went to he graduated from the University of Louisville. He came from Louisville.
Oh, Louis D. Brandeis came from Louisville.
Yeah, he came from Louisville. His parents came over from Vienna. And they settled in Louisville, see? And he went to school in Louisville, and he graduated the University of Louisville, and then went to Harvard Law School, and became a, never anything but a practicing lawyer, you know, rather. But he got to know Frankfurter, who went to CCNY, by the way, and then taught at Harvard Law School, see?
Uh-huh.
And he got to know him very well. And it was Brandeis who became the first lawyer for all the labor unions in the garments trade in New York. He knew all the garments. So did I know all the garments. Although I was on the national executive of the ZOA, and I was president of the local chapter of the ZOA, Zionist organization, and so on and so forth in my day. But I was really a labor Zionist at heart, because I'm a socialist at heart, you see. And I still am, by the way. And one of the reasons I came so close to Mr. Ben-Gurion, see, was because of the fact that, first of all, I told Ben-Gurion, and I told Weizmann, and I told all the original people, Golda Meir particularly, that my grandfather was a founder of Bilu, Rishon LeZion. They couldn't figure it. I had something they didn't have. I was more of a first family than they were, see? Because this is the first families, you know? And so and I became very friendly. Ben-Gurion had 24 boys in the world. I was one of the 24 boys all the way through this program. Anyway, starting in 1917 when the Balfour Declaration was passed and Brandeis wanted to change the coloration of the Zionist organization, he wanted to start some young Jewish Zionist organization. They founded the Menorah Society. And I was the one, Charlie Rosenblum and I founded the Menorah Society at Yale. It was the first Jewish society founded at Yale. And then Yale had a vote against Jews in those days. Jews couldn't make Greek letter fraternities in those days at Yale. And we founded Pi Lambda Phi.
Oh.
We brought it in. Charlie and I brought it in at Yale. We founded it. And I'm very, very proud of that. It didn't last very long, neither of them, by the way. 5 or 6 years, they disbanded them. But we founded them. But I've been involved ever since the Balfour Declaration, the Zionist organization. Saul Rosenblum, the father, was a very, very, very devoted Zionist. Not only that, when they founded the Hebrew University in 1918, Lord Balfour came over with Weizmann to found the Hebrew University. They bought 4 old Arab buildings on Mount Scopus. When they wanted to build a new building, the first new building, Brandeis came to Saul Rosenblum. And in 1921, Saul Rosenblum gave $1 million to build the first building. The first building in the Hebrew University is the Rosenblum Building. The first new building on Mount Scopus is a Rosenblum Building, you could say. And Saul Rosenblum died in 24 or 25. The building wasn't built until 27 or 28 or 29. And I was then Charlie Rosenblum's partner. And by that time, Charlie's younger brother, Arthur, had graduated from Yale. We took him as a partner in the Rosenblum Law and Law. But I was in on all the planning for the Rosenblum Building because I knew more about fine arts and liberal arts than they did, see, because I was always a fine arts student and so on and so forth. And the way I became a fine arts student, I have to tell you this. My sister Ray, when she entered Smith, attended the first art appreciation class ever given at a college, in any college. They didn't give them in those days. The first one. And she went to Europe, went talking. She said, that's, what's his name? That's Titian. That's this, that's that. You know, I couldn't believe that my little sister can tell me about someone. So I started to learn all about art, too. And I took painting lessons. I went to, see, that's a drawing by me of this.
Oh, that's very good.
60s.
Uh-huh.
That's years ago. But I actually studied art. I studied art and art history. And my family has studied art and art history and music and all that kind of stuff, see. But when we got up to Yale and Smith, all these people knew all about these things, you know. And we began to learn these things, believe me. We learned fast because we had to learn fast. But anyway, as I said, we became interested in Israel particularly. And as I said, I got to know Ben-Gurion, I got to know everybody. But my father already used to tour the country. He became what they call a redner, a speaker, with Ussishkin and Shmariah Levin. And I remember...
What is that?
Ussishkin and Shmariah Levin, they're the founders before Herzl. beforehand. So.
Oh, Zionism, modern Zionism.
Modern Zionism. See, Herschel really starts in 1896 as a result of the 1896, because of the Dreyfus case. The Herschel wasn't involved in the Dreyfus. But we have the data, as I told you, my father, my grandfather, and so on, starts way before that. But anyway, I became very much involved, and I attended several World Zionist Congresses in Zurich, and became involved with Weizmann, and when I knew them all personally, they all had a very high regard for me, because I told you, because I was the first family, you know, to see. And they asked me to do all kinds. I was articulate, knowledgeable, and they had me do all kinds of things. And I have collected letters from Dr. Weizmann, from Ben Gurion, and longhand.
Wow.
Longhand, I have them. Mm-hmm. But from everybody that's involved. As a matter of fact, just recently, about a year or two ago, the Hestadrut, which is a labor organization in Israel, that's so on and so forth, have been after me for years to give these documents to what they call the Kremlin, as their world headquarters in Tel Aviv, great big buildings, their world headquarters on the first floor. They have these cases, see, and they want me to present them, but I've already, I'm willing them to the Hebrew University and to...
Are you?
As my father's books. My father, when he died, left 2,000 books, volumes. And they're all in Hebrew. They're the Philip Longfellow library. And we're very much, I'm a founder of the Israel Museum. I've been very close to Hebrew University. I've known every president very, very closely. To the right today, I mean, I don't care who wrote today. And I've known everybody who's been involved. When Ben Gurion set up the first state, you know, his foreign secretary, Moshe Sharet, Sartok was the name of those days. I can't show you. I'll show you the letters I have from Sharet. And some of the wonderful episodes that we had together, you know, when I was traveling. I was the national chairman of speakers for United Israel Appeal, United Palestine Appeal, United Israel Appeal, United Jewish Appeal. I was the first national chairman for sales for Israel Bonds.
Wow.
I'm the first national chairman in 1951. My wife was the second national chairman of women for Israel Bonds. But we both worked together and so on.
Did you ever think of making Aliyah to Israel?
That's the biggest mistake of my life, that I didn't make Aliyah. I don't have a pad in Israel. It doesn't make sense. I started to do it, I'll bet you, 25 times.
Uh-huh.
And still didn't do it. I can't explain it to you. Of all the people who should have done it and who were tortured by the fact, I went there every year, twice a year, three times a year, for the university meeting, the museum meeting, the Karen Hyssod meeting. I went there for everything. See, my wife and I did. See, now I like to think, I'd like to record this. In 1936 or 37, Eddie Warburg, at the time, was head of JDC, the American Jewish Joint Distribution, the national head.
Joint Distribution Committee.
And I was at that time the head of these, all these Jewish organizations, UJ and so on and so forth. Eddie Warburg and I went to Germany. I went to Vienna to tell the Jewish community of Vienna to get out.
What year was this?
1937. And then we went to Budapest to tell the Jewish community. And what we tried to do is get the Jews to take their money out of Vienna and Budapest and invested either in Israel or in the United States. Eddie Warburg and I went, and went with me, by the way.
Did any of them listen to you?
Oh, some of them did. And it's just amazing, in those days, the Jews, the rich Jews, felt so secure. They never believed that Hitler would carry out when he carried out and so on and so forth. They never dreamed of it. See, whom do you deal with? You deal only with the richest people, see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got some of them to start a beer distillery in Israel, one of them making pop and so on and so forth in Israel, and a couple of things like that. And we, well, that's the kind of things we did. Well, anyways, I said, I've been involved in every step in Israel. My wife and I, when we first brought in the first Jews from Yemen, the Yemenites, about 40 years ago, before there was a state, you know, my Anna and I met the first, we helped hire the American pilots from World War II to go bring them from Yemen and pick them up on the plane and bring them into Yemen. And I remember we dosed them.
1947?
In 1947, I guess, 46, something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we hired American pilots who were pilots in the war. And we, I'll never forget, we DDT'd them. We put them in a big feather. And they came and they kissed the earth. My wife used to love to tell the story. A little kid, about 7 years old. About 7 years old, I'd never seen a comb. And she wanted to go to the toilet. And so my wife took her to the toilet and wanted her to wash her hands, see? And then my wife decided to brush her comb hair with her comb, you know. This kid had never seen a comb before. And loved to tell that story, how she combed. And she gave that kid her comb. So
tell us about your Anne.
Well, I married her in 1935. And